For his entire military career, Colonel Cornelius Schroeder had campaigned with native troops rather than with men of his own race and country. He much preferred them, for they were inured to hardship and less likely to be affected by heat and sun or by cold and wet. They were hardened against the fevers and plagues that struck down the white men who ventured into these tropical climes, and they survived on less food. They were able to live and fight on what frugal fare the savage and terrible land provided, whereas European troops would sicken and die if forced to undergo similar privations. There was another reason for his preference. Whereas the lives of Christian troops must be reckoned dear, these heathen could be expended without such consideration, just as cattle do not have the same value as men, and can be sent to the slaughter without qualm. Of course, they were famous thieves, and could not be trusted near women or liquor, and when forced to rely upon their own initiative, they were as little children. But with good Dutch officers over them, their courage and fighting spirit outweighed these weaknesses. Schroeder stood on a rise of ground and watched the long column of infantry file past him. It was remarkable how swiftly they had recovered from the terrible affliction of seasickness that only the previous day had prostrated most of them. A night's rest on the hard earth, and a few handfuls of dried fish and cakes of sorghum meal baked over the coals, and this morning they were cheerful and strong as when they had embarked. They strode past him on bare feet, following their white petty officers, moving easily under their burdens, chattering to each other in their own tongues. Schroeder felt more confidence in them now than at any time since they had embarked in Table Bay. He lifted his hat and mopped at his brow. The sun was only just showing above the treetops, but already it was hot as the blast from a baker's oven. He looked ahead at the hills and forest that awaited them. The map that the red-haired Scotsman had drawn for him was a rudimentary sketch that merely adumbrated the shoreline and gave no warning of this rugged terrain that they had encountered. At first he had marched along the shore, but this proved heavy going. Under their packs, the men sank ankle-deep into the sand at each pace. Also, the open beaches were interspersed with cliffs and rocky capes, which could cause further delay. So Schroeder had turned inland and sent his scouts ahead to find a way through the hills and forest. At that moment there was a shout from up ahead. A runner was coming back down the line. Panting, the Hottentot drew himself up and saluted with a flourish. "Colonel, there is a wide river ahead." Like most of these troops, he spoke good Dutch. "Name of a dog," Schroeder cursed. "We will fall further behind, and our rendezvous is only 2 days from now. Show me the way." The scout led him towards the crest of the hill. At the top of the slope, a steep river valley opened beneath his feet. The sides were almost 200 feet deep and densely covered with forest. At the bottom, the estuary was broad and brown, racing out into the sea with the tide. He drew his telescope from its leather case and carefully scanned the valley, where it cut deeply into the hills of the hinterland. "There does not seem to be an easier way to cross, and I cannot afford the time to search further." He looked down at the drop. "Fix ropes to those trees at the top, and give the men purchase on the slope." It took them half the morning to get 200 men down into the valley. At one stage a rope snapped under the weight of 50 men leaning on it to keep their footing as they descended. However, although most sustained grazes, cuts and sprains as they rolled down to the river bank, there was one serious casualty. A young Sinhalese infantryman's right leg caught in a tree root as he fell, and was fractured in a dozen places below the knee, the sharp splinters of bone sticking out of his shin. "Bell, we're down with only one man lost," Schroeder told his lieutenant with satisfaction. "Could have been more costly. We might have spent days searching for another crossing." "I will have a litter made for the injured man," Lieutenant Martsaker suggested. "Are you soft in the head?" Schroeder snapped. "He would hold up the march. Leave the clumsy fool here with a loaded pistol. When the hyena come for him, he can make his own decision who to shoot. One of them, or himself. Enough talk. Let's get on with the crossing." From the bank, Schroeder looked across a 100-yard sweep of river. The surface dimpled with small whirlpools as the outgoing tide spurred the muddy waters on their race for the sea. "We will have to build rafts," Lieutenant Martsoker ventured. But Schroeder snarled, "Nor can I afford the time for that. Get a rope across to the other bank. I must see if this river is fordable."
"The current is strong," Martsoker pointed out tactfully.
"Even a simpleton can see that, Martsoker. Perhaps that is why you had no difficulty in making the observation," said Schroeder ominously. "Pick your strongest swimmer."
Martsoker saluted and hurried down the ranks of troops.
They guessed what was in store, and everyone found something of interest to study in sky or forest, rather than meeting Martsoker's eye.
"Achmed!" he shouted at one of his corporals, grabbed his shoulder, and pulled him out of the huddle of men where he was trying to make himself inconspicuous. Resignedly, Achmed handed his musket to a man in his troop and began to strip. His naked body was hairless and yellow, sheathed in lithe, hard muscle. Martsoker knotted the rope under his armpits and sent him into the water. As Achmed edged out into the current, it rose gradually to his waist. Schroeder's hopes for a swift, easy crossing rose with it. Achmed's mates on the bank shouted encouragement as they paid out the line. Then, when he was almost halfway across, Achmed stumbled abruptly into the main channel of the river, and his head disappeared below the surface.
"Pull him back!" Schroeder ordered, and they hauled Achmed back into the shallower water, where he struggled to regain his footing, snorting and coughing up the water he'd swallowed. Suddenly, Schroeder shouted with more urgency, "Pull! Get him out of the water!"
50 yards upstream, he had seen a mighty swirl in the surface of the opaque waters. Then a swift V-shaped wake sped down the channel to where the corporal was splashing about in the shallows. The team on the rope saw it then, and with yells of consternation, they hauled Achmed in so vigorously that he was plucked over backwards and dragged thrashing and kicking towards the bank. However, the thing below the surface moved more swiftly and arrowed in on the helpless man. When it was only yards from him, its deformed black snout, gnarled and scaled as a black log, thrust through the surface, and 20 feet behind the head a crested saurian tail exploded out. The hideous monster raced across the gap and rose high out of the water, its jaws open to display the ragged files of yellow teeth. Then Achmed saw it and shrieked wildly. With a crash like a falling portcullis, the jaws closed over his lower body. Man and beast plunged below the surface in a whirlpool of creaming foam. The men on the line were jerked off their feet and dragged in a struggling heap down the bank. Schroeder leapt after them and seized the rope's end. He took 2 turns around his wrist and flung his weight back on the line. Out in the brown tide race there was another boiling explosion of foam as the huge crocodile, its fangs locked in Achmed's belly, rolled over and over at dizzying speed. The other men on the line recovered their footing and hung on grimly. There was a sudden stain of red on the brown water as Achmed was torn in half, the way a glutton might twist the leg off the carcass of a turkey. The bloodstain was whipped away and dissipated downstream by the swift current, and the straining men fell back as the resistance at the other end of the rope gave way. Achmed's upper torso was dragged ashore, arms jerking and mouth opening and shutting convulsively, like that of a dying fish. Far out in the river, the crocodile rose again, holding Achmed's legs and lower torso crosswise in its jaws. It lifted its head to the sky and gulped and strained to swallow. As the dismembered carcass slid down into its maw, they saw it bulge the soft, pale, scaly throat. Schroeder was roaring with rage.
"This foul beast will delay us for days if we allow it."
He rounded on the shaken musketeers who were dragging away Ahmed's sundered corpse.
"Bring that piece of meat back here."
They dropped the corpse at his feet and watched in awe as he stripped off his clothing and stood naked before them. Flat, hard muscle rippling his belly, and his thick penis jutting out of the mat of dark hair at its base. At his impatient order, they tied a rope under his armpits, then handed him a loaded musket with the match burning in the lock, which Schroeder shouldered. With his other hand, he grabbed Ahmed's limp, dead arm. An incredulous hum of amazement went up from the bank as Schroeder stepped into the river, dragging the bleeding remnants with him.
"Come then, filthy beast," he bellowed angrily, as the water reached his knees and he kept going. "You want to eat? Well, I have something for you to chew on."
A moan of horror burst from every throat, as upstream from where Schroeder stood, with the water at his hips, there was another tremendous swirl, and the crocodile rushed downriver towards him, leaving a long, slick wake across the brown surface. Schroeder braced himself, and then, with a round arm swing, hurled the upper half of Ahmed's dripping, dismembered corpse ahead of him into the path of the crocodile's flailing charge.
"Eat that!" he shouted, as he lifted the musket from his shoulder and levelled it at the human bait that bobbed only two arms span ahead of him. The monstrous head burst through the surface, and the mouth opened wide enough to engulf Ahmed's pitifully shredded remains. Over the sights of the gun, Schroeder looked down into its gaping jaws. He saw the ragged spikes of teeth still festooned with shreds of human flesh, and beyond them the lining of the throat, which was a lovely buttercup yellow. As the jaws opened, a tough membrane automatically closed off the throat to prevent water rushing down it into the beast's lungs. Schroeder aimed into the depths of the open throat and snapped the lock. The burning match dropped, and there was an instant of delay as the powder flared in the pan. Then, as Schroeder held his aim unwaveringly, came a deafening roar and a long silver-blue spurt of smoke flew from the muzzle straight down the throat of the crocodile. 3 ounces of antimony-hardened lead pellets drove through the membrane, tearing through the windpipe, artery and flesh, lancing deep into the chest cavity, ripping through the cold reptilian heart and lungs. Such a mighty convulsion racked the great lizard that 15 feet of its length arched clear of the water, and the grotesque head almost touched the crested tail before it fell back in a tall spout of foam. Then it rolled, dived, and burst out again, swirling in leviathan contortions. Schroeder did not pause to watch these hideous death throes, but dropped the smoking musket and dived headfirst into the deepest part of the channel. Relying on the beast's frenzy to confuse and distract any other of the deadly reptiles, he lashed out towards the far bank with a full overarm stroke. "Pay out the rope to him!"
Martsaker yelled at the men who stood paralysed with shock, and they recovered their wits. Holding it high to keep it clear of the current, they let it out as Schroeder clawed himself across the channel.
"Look out!"
Martsaker shouted, as first one, then another crocodile pushed through the surface. Their eyes were set on protuberant, horny knuckles as they were able to watch the convulsions of their dying fellow without exposing the whole of their heads. The softer splashes thrown up by Schroeder did not attract their attention until he was only a dozen strokes from the far bank, when one of the monsters sensed his presence. It turned and sped towards him, ripples spreading like a fan on each side of the twin lumps on its forehead.
"Faster!" Martsaker bellowed. "He's after you!"
Schroeder redoubled his stroke as the crocodile closed in swiftly upon him. Every man on the bank roared encouragement at him, but the crocodile was only a body length behind as Schroeder's feet touched the bottom. It raced in the last yard as Schroeder flung himself forward, and the mighty jaws snapped closed only inches behind his feet. Dragging the rope like a tail, he staggered towards the tree line, but still he was not clear of danger, for the dragon-like creature raised itself on its stubby bowed legs as it came ashore and waddled after him at a speed that the watchers could hardly credit. Schroeder reached the first tree of the forest only 10 feet ahead of it and sprang for an overhanging branch. As the snaggletooth jaws clashed shut, he was just able to lift his legs beyond their bite and, with the last of his strength, draw himself higher into the branches. The frustrated reptile lurked below, circling the bole of the tree. Then, uttering a hissing roar, it retreated slowly down the bank. It carried high its long tail, crested like a gigantic coxcomb, but as it reached the river, it lowered itself and slid back beneath the surface. Even before it had disappeared, Schroeder shouted across the river,
"Make fast your end!"
He looped his own rope end around the thick trunk beside which he was perched and knotted it. Then he yelled,
"Martsaker! Get those men busy building a raft. They can pull themselves over on the rope against the current."
The hull of the Resolution had been cleaned of weed and barnacles.
and as the crew paid off her hoving lines, she righted herself slowly against the press of the incoming tide. While she had been careened on the beach, the carpenters had finished shaping and dressing the new mainmast, and it was at last ready to step. It took every hand to carry the long, heavy spar down to the beach and lift the thick end over the gunwale. The tackle was made fast to her other two standing masts, and the slings were adjusted to raise the new spar. With gangs heaving cautiously on the lines, and Big Daniel and Ned directing them, they raised the massive length of gleaming pine towards the vertical. Sir Francis trusted no one else to supervise the crucial business of fitting the heel of the mast through the hole in the main deck, and then sliding its length down through the hull to the step on the keelson of the ship. It was a delicate operation that needed the strength of 50 men, and took most of that day. "Well done, lads," Sir Francis told them, when at last the massive spar slid home the last few inches, and the heel clunked heavily into its prepared step. "Slack off!" No longer supported by the ropes, the 50-foot mast stood of its own accord. Big Daniel shouted up to the deck from where he stood waist-deep in the lagoon, "Now woe betide those cheeseheads! 10 days from today we'll sail her out through the heads, you mark my words." Sir Francis smiled down at him from the rail. "Not before we get the shrouds on that mainmast, and that will not happen while you stand there with your mouth open and your tongue wagging." He was about to turn away when suddenly he frowned at the shore. The governor's wife had come out from the trees, followed by her maid, and now she stood at the top of the beach, spinning the handle of her parasol between her long white fingers so it revolved over her head, a brightly coloured wheel that drew the eye of every man of his crew. Even Hal, who was overseeing the gang on the foredeck, had turned from his work to gawk at her like a ninny. Today she was dressed in a fetching new costume, cut so low in front that her bosom bulged out almost to her nipples. "Mr. Courtney!" Sir Francis called, loud enough to shame his son in front of his men. "Give a mind to your work. Where are the wedges to steady that spar?" Hal started and flushed darkly under his tan as he turned from the rail and seized the heavy mallet. "You heard the captain," he snapped at his gang. "That strumpet is the Eve in this paradise." Sir Francis dropped his voice and spoke from the side of his mouth to Abberley at his shoulder. "I have seen Hal mooning at her before, and, sweet heavens, she looks back at him bold as a harlot with her dugs sticking out. He's only a boy." "You see him through a father's eyes," Abberley smiled and shook his head. "He is a boy no longer. He is a man. You told me once that your holy book speaks of an eagle in the sky and a serpent on a rock, and a man with a maid."